not only Jews. Of course, there's also a negative side. Fundamentalist Islam is partially reflective of that as well, but the concept of turning to God for various answers. But we also have a teaching in the Kabbalah that side by side with the resurgence of godliness will always be an equally opposing force towards secularism and the like. And as you know, there has been a spate of books advocating fairly aggressively atheism, whether it's the Christopher Hitchens, the very, very controversial essayist, or Richard Dawkins. Of course, Christopher Hitchens has passed away, so I imagine that he has answers to his questions at this point. Perhaps he may not enjoy the answers, but nevertheless, his doubts have been resolved. And the question basically becomes, you know, what's going on here? Now, you may recall the very famous Pascal's Wager, which is a weak argument for God, but it is an argument. Pascal made the argument that even if the probabilities were 50-50, the consequences of not believing in God if you're wrong are much more drastic than the consequences of believing in God if you're proven to be wrong. Because if you believe in God and you're proven to be wrong, well, what's the downside? You lived a virtuous life, you did good things in your life, okay. On the other hand, if you don't believe in God, and you're not to be wrong, there might be some very, very severe consequences. So Pascal argued that even as a pure betting man, it is better to opt for the divine, and even if you're wrong, than to not opt for the divine. Now, I don't want to get into Pascal's Wager because I think it's a fairly weak argument. I will also point out that one conceptual difficulty with Pascal's Wager is Pascal's Wager can be an argument to favor God over no God, but it cannot really be an argument to favor one religion over another religion, meaning vis-a-vis Pascal's Wager, you don't really know Judaism, Christianity, Islam, Buddhism, because either way, you're asserting God, and you're not sure which is right. So obviously, one has to make the case on grounds that are much stronger than simply a 50-50 gambler's, you know, gamble. So the first point I want to make, and I think this is exactly what you were talking about a minute ago, is the concept of probability. The notion that anything in this world can be proven at a level of 100% certainty is largely an illusion. There is nothing in life that is 100% certain. For example, when you take the laws of physics themselves are indeterminate. And as you know, modern physics has taught us that even such basic ideas as gravity and everything that we take for granted is really probabilistic in nature and not certainty. The fact that I throw up a ball 10 million times, and it comes down, creates an extremely strong probability that the next time I throw it, it'll go down. But it is only a probability, you know, it is not a certainty, right? That's one of the cornerstones of modern physics. When you wake up in the morning and you swing your leg over the bed, most of us don't look to see if there's still a floor there. Theoretically, it's possible that the whole building collapsed and you're simply on top of a kind of a hill or a mountain having your bed, and there's no floor around you. But we don't check because experience teaches us that the probabilities are it's probably going to be there. Who we marry, where we work, what we will do for a living, how we will raise our children, are all judgments that are based on the probabilities of accumulated experience, whether it's our personal experience or whether it's the collective experience of people who have wisdom and life. So it's a little ingenuous, or disingenuous rather, when somebody says, well, I need 100% proof of God. The case for God does not require 100% certainty. And in fact, God deliberately created a world or a universe where that certainty is not going to be 100% for a very simple reason. God wants there to be a world of choice, free will. Free will is fundamental to Judaism, extremely important to Judaism. Because if you believed in determinism, that God just made you whatever you are, then there could be no accountability for good or evil, because if I'm virtuous, my DNA made me virtuous. And if I'm evil, you know, the devil made me do it, or my DNA made me do it, or whatever it would be. So Judaism is predicated on moral autonomy and free will. But if God's presence could be established to a magnitude of 100% certainty, whatever that would mean, at that point you can no longer make a choice. The choice, as it were, would be no more morally significant than my choosing to say the light is on. Well, the light is obviously on, so there's nothing to choose. So if you think about it, the questions and the doubts that people have are inextricably linked to the moral imperative of free will. But let me just digress for a moment on this. You know, recently, within the past 15 years, the scientific community has done much of the mapping and sequencing of the human genome, and things are still proceeding apace. We've mapped out the genetic structure of the human organism. And if you've been following this, number one, there's a lot of promise. We're going to discover a lot of diseases, genetically linked, etc., at least predictors. But the more we get into this, the more we see that it's not just physical conditions that are linked genetically, but even conditions that we would associate with emotions and the like. So for example, I'm oversimplifying. You know, there's the anger gene, certain propensity towards anger. We'll find the axe murderer gene, the disorganization gene, all sorts of things. Now, this actually raises some serious philosophical questions. That is, as we increasingly trace things to genetics, biology, the biochemical composition of the DNA within your cells, are we moving away from an ethic that is based on responsibility? After all, cannot the axe murderer say, I have a genetic predisposition to dismember people? I can't be responsible. Now, this may sound absurd, but rest assured there are criminal attorneys, particularly in California, who are exploring these as defenses. They've already brought us the PMS, the premenstrual syndrome defense. It hasn't been that successful, but it's been brought up. Or the sugar high defense. I go crazy when I'm on sugar, or whatever it would be. Well, now it can be a little more sophisticated. And philosophically, people are beginning to think about this problem. That is, does genetics replace human moral responsibility by impairing the capacity for choice? Now, there are two points to keep in mind here. Point number one is that anyone that makes that type of argument has really a very, very crude understanding of the role that genetics plays in human choices. Genetics is never deterministic in an absolute sense. I mean, in some cases, some physical cases it might be. But genetics indicates propensities, tendencies, which then in turn interact with the environment in certain ways. To give you an example, there is a gene, the BRCA1 gene, which is a genetic marker for breast cancer in Ashkenazic Jewish women. And this can be tested ahead of time. And one would think, well, women might as well get tested to know, but the truth is it's a very controversial proposition because the presence of the gene does not mean the woman will get breast cancer, and the absence of the gene does not mean that the woman won't get breast cancer. Rather, genetic markers tend to be in themselves probabilistic. Tendencies, greater probabilities that when there's an interaction with certain environmental carcinogens, things will be triggered. So to say that if somebody has, I'm being facetious, the axe murderer gene, they're going to be an axe murderer and they don't have choice, that's totally false. It may mean they'll have a harder time. That, those are the challenges God puts in our lives. So one has to remember that free will is not obscured by genetics. Biology is not destiny. Biology may create the parameters of your struggle. But every human being has a struggle on some level. And our religious and moral job in life is to make the right choices. Now, this is captured quite beautifully in a Talmudic text. The Talmud was not aware of DNA. That's not the text, that's not the science that it talks about. The Talmud instead talked about the stars, the constellations. By the word mazel, as you know, actually means constellations. When you wish somebody mazel tov, which is colloquial for good luck, it actually means may your stars be aligned in the right way. It's kind of, there is some connection to astrology. Now again, Maimonides considered astrology a pseudoscience and just a bunch of superstition. And that's kind of the normative Jewish position. Nevertheless, in colloquial speech, we do invoke the vocabulary of the stars, although we don't necessarily believe in it that much. But be it as it may, the Talmud at one point did indeed assert that your personality is determined by the stars that you're born under. And the Talmud then says, he who is born under the influence of the red planet, which we know, of course, is Mars, is going to be a lover of bloodshed. He cannot avoid it. He will love the sight of blood. But he may choose to be a shochet, one who slaughters kosher animals, or a mohel, one who circumcises Jewish boys, or a murderer. The choice is his own. Now, you can look at a passage like this in the Gemara, and you can look at it in two ways. Superficially, you could mock the Gemara. You could say, oh, they believe in planets, they believe in stars, they believe in astrology and all that pseudoscience and superstition. You could look at it that way. But there's a much more profound meaning here. Whether we talk about the stars or whether we talk about DNA really makes no difference. The Talmud is addressing the conflict between the notion of free will and the notion of a predetermined hardwiring that is within your system. They call that hardwiring the influence of the planets. We call it DNA. It really makes no difference, because the philosophical problem is the same problem. How can a human being have free choice if so much of his personality is predetermined? The fact that they use the planets to describe the predetermined part of your personality is really incidental. And the Talmud's answer is, your essential nature is predetermined, but what you choose to do with it is a matter of your autonomy. So, you're going to love blood, but you have the capacity to direct those choices in a good, productive, noble way, or an evil way. Now, that's a very important insight for the Genome Project today. There may be a lot of characteristics within you, within us, that are predetermined and we don't have a lot of control over. That might be so, but that doesn't eliminate the idea of choice. Okay, there is choice within the parameters. So you can't necessarily take away the bloodlust, to give one example, but it can be channeled and directed in constructive ways. Okay? So going back to the God issue. The issue here, therefore, is never going to be one of certainty. God has created a world in which there will be some uncertainty in order to facilitate free will. But at the same time, one does not have the right to insist on a greater level of certainty than one would insist on any other decision you make in your life. When you get married, you don't insist on 100% certainty. Insist on the balance of a strong, reasonable probability. So this is what we're going to say the case for God is, meaning I'm not going to assert certainty, although I think you will discover more certainty as it goes on, but at least in the initial stages of one's exploration, the case is predicated on the reasonable probabilities of the same magnitude that you decide who you're going to marry, where you're going to work, and how you're going to live. Okay? And that's really the case here. So when we start, and by the way, just as a little aside, you know, anyone know the Hebrew word for world?
Olam.
Olam, right. So in the Hasidic literature, it is written that Olam, which means world, has the same root as He'elam, which is concealment, meaning the nature of this world is that God's presence is hidden and concealed and is not always going to be as obvious. But if we go back to the general arguments that have been made, that there is a supreme creator who brought everything together. By the way, in another lecture we'll talk about the fact that how God created the world is much less important than the fact that he did create it. So, for example, Jewish thought, here I'm being a little controversial, but at least I'm telling you my understanding, Jewish thought is can be very, very comfortable with Big Bang and evolution and all sorts of other issues. We'll talk about that. Because as long as one posits that it was guided and not arbitrary, God could have employed, you know, God did employ the laws of chemistry, physics, etc., in creating the world. So the issues of evolution are not really major theological issues, as far as I'm concerned, as long as one posits a guiding intelligence in the implementation of those laws. But we'll talk about that more. But one of the arguments, you know, that have been advanced for the existence of God, actually going back to Abraham, is technically, goes by the technical name, the argument from design. That is, according to rabbinic tradition, Abraham, the first Jew, who grew up in a house of paganism, discovered his belief in God at the first time at the age of three, precocious age of three. And how did he discover it? He looked at the world and he saw the combination of the marvelous complexity and diversity of this world. But at the same time, he saw a fundamental unity, how everything worked together, and how all of the billions and billions of phenomena in the world can be traced to a relatively few types of interactions. And he saw the evidence of this beauty, this complexity, and this elegance as evidence of a supreme mind, as it were, that was consciously orchestrating all of these things. The technical name for this argument is called the argument from design. It was advanced both by a Jewish and Christian and other theologians as well. The analogy that's often given is if you were walking in the desert and you found a book that contained Shakespeare's plays, you could not assume it was the product of the arbitrary spilling of ink that happened to form words, because probabilistically that's not likely. And when you see design, when you see structure, when you see interactivity, when you see how everything comes together, so if you have two choices, is it a product of randomness or is it a product of conscious direction? Once again, the probability is that when you see structure, there would tend to be intentionality that would support the notion of a creator. And I want to point out that even people who were not religious in a formalistic sense often had these intuitions. And the most outstanding example is none other than Albert Einstein. Albert Einstein, Jewish, but not, he was not a believer in God in the classic sense. He did not believe that God gave human beings commandments. That was, but he absolutely believed in an overall cosmic consciousness that structured the universe. Because he saw in the complexity of the world the ability to reduce what is going on to some fundamental laws. And in fact, as you know, he spent, actually some physicists feel, he wasted the last 30 years of his life. But after discovering a phenomenon like relativity and the like, he spent literally 30 years of his life looking for what is called the field theory of everything, in which he wanted to find single laws that would unite gravity and electromagnetism and all of the phenomena of nature. He got it down to three basic laws, but he wanted to get one, because he was convinced that from unity comes unity. And there was a deep religious consciousness in the fact that the man who penetrated the mysteries of the universe, perhaps more than anyone else ever did, ultimately was convinced of the intelligent creator behind this design.
How would you explain what Hawking would have to say, though?
Well, you're correct. There are some exceptions. Hawking is...
Einstein's contemporary.
Well, exactly. Well, he's much younger.
Well, obviously, but yeah. I mean, he's in the same direction astrophysicist working on phenomena?
Well, I have to say the following. I have to say that, although I have a bias, admittedly, I would trust Einstein more than Hawking for the following reason. Not detracting at all from Hawking's brilliance and also his courage in persevering and being so successful and productive in spite of his physical disabilities. But you have to understand, there is a built-in bias in the human personality not to accept God. And this is actually why we demand such high probabilities. And part of that is, accepting of God has implications for how I live my day-to-day life. And we are inherently very stubborn to have to make those types of changes. So traditional rabbinic lore would call that the Yetzer Hara. There's a certain negative inclination to pull me away from godliness simply because there are implications for change that I might be uncomfortable with. So once again, I don't think Hawking himself has ever made a convincing case there is no God, but I guess he just feels that the probability has not been established to a high enough magnitude. Well, once again, obviously people do differ, and I'm not, but once again, I'm not ever suggesting any argument is compelling.
Right.
But it's just something that people like Einstein have considered, and of course, Einstein's great predecessor, going back 200 years, Sir Isaac Newton. Of course, in many ways, Einstein physics and quantum mechanics displaced Newtonian physics. But Newton, too, who was the first really proponent of the orderly laws that govern macro phenomena. And by the way, Newtonian physics still governs big things. It just doesn't govern little things. So for example, every day, if we go on airplanes and everything else, we're relying on Newton's laws of physics. We're not relying on uncertainty or quantum mechanics. If you relied on that, you know, I wouldn't want to go on a plane, with kind of the uncertainty of how it's going to react. So in a very, very strange and complex way, large phenomena are still operating with the laws of Newtonian physics. It's only on the subatomic level that everything is unpredictable, which is truly amazing in and of itself, because if big stuff, I'm going to be very simplistic, if big stuff is just made of a bunch of small stuff, then if the small stuff is unpredictable, how can the big stuff be predictable, right? And that's kind of an amazing paradox within the physical structure of the universe. But that's really how it is, to be very simplistic. I hope nobody here is a graduate student of physics, then I'm really in trouble. But the basic idea is, big stuff is governed by Newton, and small stuff is governed by quantum mechanics. And these are two opposite systems, and yet they both kind of coexist in the physical world that we live in. But once again, Einstein, in his famous statement he said over many, many times, he says, he doesn't believe that God plays with dice. God has rules, God has order, God has structure. There is elegance in the world. And this elegance itself is proof, at least to Einstein's mind, of the notion of a supreme creator. So in many, many ways, according to Maimonides, who's a great doctor as well as rabbi, he actually says that the study of science on a deep level can actually bring one to God. Not always, Stephen Hawking is an outstanding example, but many, many of the scientists had a deep religious sensibility. Now, it didn't translate automatically to becoming an Orthodox Jew. That's a separate jump. But the notion of seeing God. Isaac Newton, by the way, although his brilliance is really unbelievable, but, you know, he discovered, you know, he invented calculus, basically, and optics, and discovered articulated gravity and everything else. But, you know, physics was really his hobby. His real passion was biblical commentary. Newton actually wrote commentaries on the Bible that we still have. And he was absolutely convinced in a God. And in fact, in one of his famous statements, when he was trying to discover these universal laws, he said, God loves simplicity and elegance. And therefore, that's what you look for in understanding the world. Not to have a bunch of billions of unrelated phenomena, but to connect everything together. This is referred to as the argument from design. Now let me mention a related argument, which is not exactly the same, but you might call it a first cousin, maybe even a sibling. that is something that's been identified in recent years, the anthropomorphic principle. And this has been acknowledged even by atheists. You know, one of the most famous evolutionary biologists of the 20th century, he died 10 years ago, was Stephen Jay Gould, Jewish guy, professor at Harvard University. Now, when I say he was most famous, I don't mean that he himself did pathbreaking work, but he was an extremely articulate popularizer of evolutionary science. And you know, he wrote many, many books, and many, many people learned about evolutionary science through the very, very clear writings of Stephen Jay Gould. And Stephen Jay Gould, who absolutely did not believe in God, but he said that the conditions for human life are so fragile that he says, it's almost as if somebody was inviting us to be here, which of course he did not accept. He just pointed out as an anomaly. By that I mean the following. In order for human life, really for life, in order for life to exist, there are a number of specific conditions that have to be met. You need an atmosphere of the right chemical components. The oxygen, but it has to be balanced with other things as well. You need a precise temperature range. Right? You need certain atmospheric conditions. Now, if the Earth would be even slightly closer to the sun than it is, or slightly further away from the sun, or if the chemical composition of the atmosphere would be different in any other way, and they enumerate like 50 or 60 of these things, life would be impossible. Life exists only because there are thousands of factors that come together in a symmetry. Now, the question then becomes, if one doesn't posit an intelligent design, an intelligent creator, we then have to ask ourselves, okay, chemical reactions are products of randomness. Let's make that assumption. But what are the probabilities that all of these things would come together in order to produce life? And again, statisticians, I cannot do the computation myself, but they have computed this in terms of, you know, one in many, many billions.
So by what you're saying, if God were to exist and does, what does it take? Do you believe in aliens? There's life out there somewhere? Because, I mean, there are billions of galaxies, and there's just so much potential that even though we don't see it, I mean, we haven't traveled. Obviously, we've been to, you know, our solar system, but there's so many that,
right,
you know.
Right.
Life of some form.
There may even be more than one universe. Right? There's multiverses.
Right.
Well, you know, we can talk about that. I wouldn't rule out the possibility of intelligent life on other planets.
How would that be in the favor of believing in a God, if you were to say so?
Maybe there's orthodox Jews in the other planets.
God is infinite, and God could create all sorts of situations.
Okay.
Otherwise, that wouldn't undermine my faith. Yeah.
All right.
There's this equation called the R equation by NASA, which calculates the amount of planets that are like Earth in other galaxies, so you can figure out roughly based on a ton of different variables how many Earths there might be in other galaxies, if there are other humans, i.e. aliens like us. So,
well, that would be interesting. I think now that there's a... there was something called the WOW communication. I just saw this a few days ago, that apparently, you know, we get all sorts of radio signals and all sorts of signals from space. Most of it are just junk. There's no particular meaning that we can assign. But apparently, around 30 years ago, there was one communication, not a communication, one receipt of some radiation that seemed to have some intelligent recurring pattern. And that was labeled WOW, because somebody put WOW inside of the transcript of the communication. And there was a thought in NASA that this was an attempt of some distant life form on another planet to communicate with us. And I don't know why it took them 30 years, but now they're trying to formulate some response. to send back. Now, obviously, they didn't get a letter in English. They got something, but by analyzing the patterns, it seems like a meaningful communication. Yeah.
Just an interesting comment to be talking about probability. I think it's clear to us, or maybe we don't know, that there are many more planets that don't have life than do have life out there. And if things did not come together, let's say the dice or what the chances don't give us life, all the right variables don't come together, we wouldn't be able to say, like, oh, we missed again. It's just that there's, you know, one right combination that everyone is here.
Yeah.
So I don't know if there's a way to say it looks next to impossible, because there are infinite chances.
Yes, actually, that is an argument that I've heard mathematicians make, because they say the following. If there's a 1 in trillion chance that something will happen, that means in a trillion times it will happen. So if you have a trillion planets, mm-hmm. there'll be one that has life, no matter how high the odds are, as long as your pool is equal to the total probability, right? So a 1 in trillion chance will work out 1 in trillion times. Yeah, you know, it is an argument, but once again, I suppose the question you have to ask yourself, going back to the reasonable probability of decision making, what is the it's like a probability on a probability. What is the probability that I'm the result of the 1 in trillion chance instead of some conscious creator, right? In other words, what's the more likely way? Now, I talked about the Eight Sahara, how people are reluctant to accept the God idea, primarily because it's not just an abstraction, it has real consequences, right? Hey, if there's a God, I gotta get up 7 o'clock in the morning to God. Things like that. So, let me give you a very absurd example of how strong that Yetzer Hara is. Although I'm not pushing this as any type of proof, but I'm sure you may have heard of the Bible Codes. Are you familiar with that?
Mm-hmm.
The Bible Codes were developed by some religious computer people, and they found in the text of the Jewish Torah that certain messages can be encoded, and the messages seem to refer to events that haven't happened yet. So, for example, if you look in the Torah reading about destroying the evil nation of Amalek, and you take every 7th letter, it spells out the name Hitler and the like. And they have like hundreds of these encoded messages, and they use them as proof, although again, on the merits, it is not a strong case, actually. But they use it as proof that the Torah was written by God because of these predictions that were made. Of course, the problem basically is every prediction that we find is something that already happened. In other words, we're reading back the present into it. Unfortunately, we're not able to predict, you know, what's going to happen because we don't know what we're looking for yet. That's kind of a conceptual problem. And, you know, and they run these things on War and Peace and the New York Times, and they try to find encoding in other texts, and they claim they haven't found it. Now, again, I'm not convinced, and I don't consider it to be that valuable, but there was a fellow, Michael Drosnin, who was absolutely convinced. This really floored him. And he was amazed, but he was also an atheist. So he didn't know how to reconcile his atheistic beliefs with this thing that really blew his mind. So he was convinced that there were super knowledgeable aliens who seeded the earth with these sacred texts and these encoded messages, and that's how it got done. Now, think about probabilities here. Here's a guy who convinced himself, you know, rightly or wrongly, that this is beyond human capacity. And his two conclusions are to assert there's a God, or to assert they're like little Martians, green men, seeding the earth. And he says, I'll go with the Martians. I'll go with the Martians. Because if the Martians did it, I don't have to put on tefillin tomorrow morning. If God did it, I might be in trouble. So that's, I think, a good example of the Eight Sahara sometimes not wanting us to make that next step. I'm sorry, someone had a
The Bible Code, doesn't that go against the idea of free will taking precedence? If these things already were meant to happen, then how can we have ever had the choice to make certain things happen?
Well, that's actually a very, very excellent question. Of course, that's why it's encoded. I mean, had it been explicit, there would be a problem. Because God, see, in a sense, you could ask it maybe even in a more general way, that God knows the future. Right. So the concept is God knows the future, but he doesn't tell us the future, so we don't know it until it happened, and it is a function of our free will.
Okay.
So that's why the encoding only becomes apparent after the fact. It's not going to be before the fact.
So it has no effect
on
free will.
Because that would encode free will. Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, just as humans, like, we want to find patterns in certain texts or in life in general, just so we can understand it better. So I think just as human beings, it's our nature to try to find patterns of things,
yes,
to understand the world around us. So these patterns that you find in the Torah could just be there because we want to see them.
Well, that's very possible. Now I do believe, because of my own beliefs, that everything is in the Torah. But I think the science that was used to discern these particular patterns is highly suspect. And,
right.
And you're correct. We have a propensity. We read into things.
Right.
Of course, one might make a subsidiary argument, though, that the desire, which is kind of a hardwired desire of the human being, to make sense of things, to see patterns, to perceive unity, in itself is a kind of a God-given attribute, so that we will try to perceive God in the universe. And that's part of what some biologists call the God gene. And they actually maintain there is a genetic predisposition to believe in the Creator. Now, you can take that two ways. Some atheists who might accept that mock it and say, oh, so you see, it's not because it's true, it's just because we have genetic predispositions that maybe we have to overcome. But the counter-argument is, hey, if you believe in God, he made the genetics, and maybe there's a reason why he programmed us a certain way.
I wanted to ask this question yesterday as well. I heard at some point that the Torah was given to us with no spaces. So, like, for example, the first two words, you could, like, play with that instead of Bereshit Bara, instead of knowledge.
Yeah.
So I was just wondering, where did the spaces come from?
So I want to clarify that a little bit. The Torah was given to us with spaces. That's not the question. However, there is a tradition that there was a primeval Torah that God had, that God made, even before the world was created. And it was black fire inscribed on white fire. The white fire was the background. And that primeval Torah did not take the form of actual words, because there was no Adam, there was no Eve, there was no Moses, there were no people. But it was just the unbroken sequence of letters that represents the totality of divine power. So what you're saying is true, but historically, by the time we were given the Torah, it then took on the form of commandments, narratives, words, and divisions. Okay? So you're talking about the primeval, original Torah that existed with God before there was even the creation of the world. Yeah.
You said earlier that hearing evolution and, like, creation of man according to the Torah kind of coincide and work together.
Yeah.
But I've always been too to, like, contradict each other. So, like, I'm hoping you kind of maybe elaborate on that a little bit.
Well, yes, we actually have a whole other lecture on age of the earth, which will include evolution and other things. So, I'm going to talk about that.
No, we will.
We will very definitely talk about that. Yeah.
There's something. There's a word for the world that existed before the earth.
Yes.
There's a, I don't know, the world, or there's a few of them.
There was like 57.
Well, Olam Haba is the world to come.
Yeah, before.
Actually, I myself don't know in particular. I know the concept you're referring to, but I don't have a term for it.
Hashem even told Moses, so Moses went to get to you. Torah existed before the humans existed.
That's correct.
For everyone.
That's correct. Black fire on white fire. That's correct. And it existed as an unbroken sequence of letters.
Yeah.
And that's correct. In fact, the Bible codes are based on that. That the reason they do these encodings is they ignore the word divisions and just take, you know, every seventh letter, every tenth letter, they spell out different things. Yeah.
So, let's say hypothetically that we find, like, alien life form, some other planet that's far more intelligent than we were, that know more than we do, have, like, maybe even a better formula, or maybe actually the formula to, like, I don't know, like, synthesize everything. Would that mean that we're still the chosen people?
Well, you know, that's a very, very hard question. I suppose the concept is that we are the chosen people for the Milky Way galaxy. You know, we are chosen within the framework of the lives that we live and the world that we inhabit. There might perhaps be other choices in different places. Okay, now I want to mention another aspect, which is more of an intuitionist idea of God, which I think ultimately might be stronger than the philosophical arguments. That is, those of you who have taken political science courses or moral philosophy courses are undoubtedly familiar with the work of Thomas Hobbes. Thomas Hobbes, 18th century British curmudgeon, author of one of the great interesting works on political theory, The Leviathan. And Thomas Hobbes, rare in his time, and he was persecuted because of it, was someone who didn't believe in God, or at least didn't believe in organized religion, Church of England, and everything else. And Thomas Hobbes tried to write a treatise describing why governments are formed by factoring out things like divine rights of kings and the like. He wanted to get rid of all of that stuff. And Thomas Hobbes was a realist, somewhat like Machiavelli, but in a different way, cynical. And Thomas Hobbes believed that people are naturally brutish and cruel and selfish, and they form societies to prevent their victimization by other people who are nasty, brutish, and selfish. In other words, unlike, you know, John Locke, who talks about the social contract in kind of a romantic way, Hobbes was very, very pragmatic. Hobbes basically said, I agree not to kill you, because if I would allow myself to kill you, I would be allowing you to kill me, and I wouldn't be safe in my life. And therefore, the social contract is people agree to give up their propensity towards violence and self-control. They agree to assume a certain measure of self-control in order that they shouldn't be victimized by the other. This is kind of what you might call the dark vision of the social contract. And Hobbes points out that without a government structure, without a state, people are just going to kill each other, because after all, the primary motivation of life is self-interest. Looking after number one. That's the ethics of the fathers, actually said this. It says, you should always pray for the welfare of the government, because without the government, each man would swallow up the other one alive. That's kind of an echo of Hobbes. So Hobbes sees that the essence of morality is self-preservation. It's an important idea, meaning the reason I'm good to you is not because I care about you at all, but I'm good to you because if I wouldn't be good to you, you wouldn't be good to me, and I would suffer. And therefore, it's in the best interest of my self-preservation that we take care of each other, simply because otherwise you're going to kill me. Right? That's kind of the Hobbesian thesis in the Leviathan. And what he was trying to do is, he was trying to create a non-theistic basis for morality. And actually, I hope you see, in the context of the time, why this was pretty revolutionary. Because if you would ask an average Church of England religious guy, why do you have to be moral? They would say, well, because God commanded us to be moral, we have to follow God. That's why Dostoevsky writes, right? Dostoevsky claims that without a belief in God, no morality, there is no moral principle that can exist. I mean, without God, everything's better. Without God, why shouldn't I kill you? Now, Hobbes tried to give a non-theistic answer to morality by saying morality is grounded in the instinct for self-preservation. Everyone got that. Now, here's the problem with Hobbes, and I think this gives rise to a fairly strong intuitionist idea for God. Human beings are capable of great altruism. They are capable of self-sacrifice. They are willing to give their lives and make moral decisions which are not in the interests of their self-preservation, and in fact will jeopardize their own self-preservation in the interest of a higher calling. I don't know if you guys have gone to Yad Vashem. Have you gone to Yad Vashem?
Yeah, before.
Okay, I guess, Well, Yad Vashem is the Israeli National Museum for Holocaust Remembrance. And there's a section of Yad Vashem that is devoted to the righteous Gentiles, like Schindler's List and the like, you know, who were willing to take care of Jews during the Holocaust. Now, Thomas Hobbes might have a little difficulty with that. If Thomas Hobbes says, I am a moral person because that enhances my self-preservation, what about the moral decisions that people make, and there were far too few, in which you're endangering your life in the interest of something good? You can't say, I'm sheltering a Jew because it enhances my self-preservation at a time and in a place when it's endangering your life. So the question is, if the only thing that's working within a human being is the instinct of self-preservation, then where is the source of morality that is counter to that self-preservation? And where is the source of other things as well? Love of family, love of friends, even an appreciation for things which are non-essential, such as music and color and the like, right? All of those things. So I call this an intuitionist argument. The intuitionist argument is that if you believe in God, and God implanted into us a divine soul, one can understand the receptivity, the instinctual morality that human beings have, the ability and willingness to even give their lives to behave in a proper way, at least when we can rise to the occasion. If you factor out God, it's a little more difficult to explain the source of altruistic morality that does not enhance self-preservation. The Hobbesian non-theistic vision of morality does not really adequately explain self-sacrifice and the willingness to give your life for something good.
Those people that, you know, took care of Jewish people during the Holocaust,
yeah,
and helped them,
yeah,
it's actually the complete opposite of self-preservation.
That's right. That's exactly the point. That's exactly, so where does that
so
come from?
That, yeah.
Hobbes has no explanation for that.
Were
now,
they the exception,
though? Huh?
Were they the exception?
Well, they were the exception, but that doesn't mean anything. That just means the Yetzer Hara is very, very strong. In other words, that just means most of us, I'm not even, the truth is, I don't even condemn, I mean, this may sound crazy. A German or a Pole who was not actively involved in killing Jews, but did not feel able to take them in, I can't condemn them as evil. They were afraid for their own lives. It's a different thing if you're an active participant in the evil or something else. So the concept is, those who took in the Jews were saints. They were righteous. They were tzaddikim. Those who didn't failed to reach that level of righteousness. But once again, we have to ask ourselves hard questions. If the shoe would have been on the other foot, would we have risen to that occasion? You know, maybe not. I hope we would, but maybe not. You know, so this is one thing to think about, that sometimes what can move a person to believe in God is not necessarily the structure of physics and chemistry, but the potential for goodness that you see in the human soul, which only comes out sporadically. It's not there that often. But when it comes out, you see a beauty that is a reflection of the divine presence within. There was a great, great rabbi of the 19th century, Rabbi Israel of Salanter, who developed a whole school of thought on character development. And he had seen in his time that too many Jews were so religious in an external way, but they didn't have the quality, they didn't fully develop the qualities of compassion and care and humility. And he stressed developing these qualities. This is called Musar. And one of his disciples once said a very, very interesting remark. He said, Charles Darwin believed that man came from ape only because he never met Rabbi Israel Salanter. If he would have met Rabbi Salanter, he would have known only God could have made such a human being. Now again, that's not a philosophical argument, but sometimes it's just the goodness and righteousness that can make us feel this comes from God, because these are not pragmatic things. These are not self-survival things. These are people making decisions of sacrifice and goodness, which could not be grounded in the Hobbesian idea of the instinct of self-preservation.
I just have an interesting thought about this. First of all, you were mentioning genetics, which can predispose you to certain behaviors. Besides that, Hobbes does have a very extreme point of view. People could behave differently, even if they're not constantly wanting to destroy each other. They don't necessarily have to behave altruistically or give up their own lives for someone else. They could behave rude to one another and still not be killing each other.
Obviously you have to tinker with Hobbes a little bit, because Hobbes is only dealing with the extreme cases. Why don't I murder you to take your car?
Right.
So Hobbes says, because otherwise you'll murder me to take my car.
Right. I'm just suggesting there's probably a more...
In other words, how would Hobbes understand common courtesy? Okay, that's how certain subtleties.
Right.
Maybe Hobbes didn't have common courtesy, actually. He was kind of a rough guy.
I was going to ask, we were talking earlier about the evil inclination when it meets her. Yetzirah existed, it was part of existence within the earth, and it's like in our earth, it's already was made with the world, and that's why it's hard for man to battle this Yetzirah constantly, and even when there was this one part where angels were asking Hashem, look at the humans, they didn't have God in this world, look what they would do by themselves. They would destroy the whole world, they would destroy themselves, they would destroy everything. And Hashem told the angels, he said, if you guys were on earth, and it was the other way around, it would be worse. Mm-hmm. You guys would be worse, because,
Yetzirah is very, very powerful.
Yeah.
Although, it's kind of complicated because according to the Zohar, the Yetzirah does have a constructive function within man. It is that which propels man towards achievement. Meaning to say, if you didn't have the Yetzirah, your personality would be totally submissive to God, but you would kind of leave it to God to do everything. We talked about this the other day. And therefore, the Yetzirah is that which propels me to be an autonomous actor. Now, the downside is it causes me to rebel against God. That's not a good thing. But it is also the positive, constructive source for all progress. That's a very, very interesting dynamic. You need a certain amount of ego to achieve things in the world. If you literally have no ego at all, you're not going to do anything. I'm sorry,
Yeah, there was something that Kaplan said yesterday, which is that we're supposed to submit to the will of God and kind of not suppress our ego, but just shave it down. But how do you rectify
that's really the big dilemma. I mentioned a few times, and you get your first from other people as well, that faith in God is not a passive state. It does not simply mean I stay at home and God will take care of things.
Right.
But I have to actively do things in the world. And I have to be convinced that God gave me the power. I have to feel empowered. I have to feel liberated. I have to feel that God has given me abilities that have to be used in a powerful and constructive way. At the same time, don't slide over into arrogance and the illusion of self-sufficiency and hubris. That's very, very difficult because we tend to navigate from one extreme or the other.
So it's more like you're finding the traits within you that are God-given
That's correct. So Moses is praised as the most humble of all people.
Yeah.
And yet Moses was the leader of 3 million people over a period of 40 years. And he certainly was not passive or, ineffectual. He took command of the situation. So that's a difficult point to navigate. So these are just some things to think about. Now, the thing is, faith in God is not a static thing. it ebbs and it flows and it grows and sometimes it diminishes. It's really a struggle, it's a journey that you go through in life all the time. I will tell you that sometimes as you keep the Torah, as you feel its positive effect on you, as you see how it can help you build a family and transmit meaning to your children, sometimes it is the very process of living the life of a Jew that brings you to God. Which means, I'll just end here, spiritually, it may be a reversal of cause and effect. Meaning, a person might say quite logically, when I'm convinced that they're God, then I'll keep the Torah. I mean, that's the logical way. If I believe in God, then I'll keep the Torah. But spiritually, it often works the other way. That sometimes you start by keeping stuff, even if you're not totally convinced about God yet. And in the course of living the life of a Jew, internally you become more and more connected to the Almighty. This is why when the Jews received the Torah, they said, Na'aseh. They took our tefillin and said, we will do, and from our doing we will come to understand. So I hope at a minimum, you have a chance to experience the intense life of a Jew. And that itself, even in a non-cognitive way, that changes you in a lot of different ways. And then you're able to look at things in a very different light. They tell the story, the greatest yeshiva in Europe in the 19th century, world famous yeshiva, was the Volozhin yeshiva. I don't know if you ever heard of it, but it was like the greatest yeshiva. So there were a bunch of German Jewish university students who weren't even religious, but they were philosophy students. And they were studying about God, and they wanted all sorts of proofs, and they had questions about God. So they sent one of their members to the Volozhin yeshiva to get answers to the questions. And the person went to the Volozhin yeshiva in a totally different environment. He was a secular university student. And he spent a whole year in the Volozhin yeshiva. Then he was going to go back to his colleagues to report. Now, obviously, he was different. He had tzitzis. He was already religious, etc. And when they asked him, did you get answers to the questions?
No more questions.
He said, well, I don't know what the questions are anymore. Meaning to say, I don't have the answers, but I also don't have questions. So it's an interesting idea that sometimes questions kind of answer themselves, not in the sense that the question is not important, the questions are important, but sometimes they're less compelling. They push on us less because we see an overall meaning in our lives which can coexist even with questions. You can be a Jew with doubts, you can be a Jew with questions, but at some point the questions kind of recede a little bit because you see the overall richness of the way of God and the way of the Torah. Okay? So be well, we'll see you tomorrow, and
thank you, Robert.
Every time I go, shh, he stops.
Oh my God, he continues.
He's a hooster.
It's funny.
He's
like, well,
I'm just going in. Sometimes they're foolish because so bad. All right, what was that?
Okay, yeah, I'm not feeling it today. I'm like, we're going to go jeeping later. I'm not. Like, I got up, put on shorts, and I'm like, sitting on the bed.
Yeah, everyone was back.